The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia, and thank you very much for joining us. I'm Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to be here. Dr. Keisha N. Blaine is a 2022 New American National Fellow and a historian of the 20th century United States. She is the author of the multi-award-winning book, Set the World on Fire, Black Nationalist Women and the Global Struggle for Freedom. And she has published extensively on race, gender, and politics in both national and global perspectives. She is a recipient of numerous awards and fellowships, including a W.E.B. Du Bois Fellowship at Harvard University. She is an associate professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh and the president of the African American Intellectual History Society. Her latest books are the number one New York Times bestseller, 400 Souls, A Community History of African America, 1619 to 2019, edited with Ibram X. Kendi, and the book she brings to us this evening, Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message for America. She will be joined this evening in conversation with Mitchell S. Jackson, John O. Whiteman Dean's Distinguished Professor in the Department of English. The recipient of a 2021 Guggenheim Fellowship, he won the 2021 Pulitzer Prize in Feature Writing for his article about the killing of Ahmaud Arbery. He is the author of the novel The Residue Years and the nonfiction book Survival Math, Notes on an All-American Family. Thank you so much for being here. The screen is all yours.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Very happy to be here. Excited to hear you speak and also excited to hear you read. And I just wanted to say in the introduction, I know it can't get old hearing that you have a number one New York Times bestseller. Like, I want to know, does it make your heart flutter when you hear that?
It's exciting. And thank you so much for, you know, your contribution to 400 Souls. It was really remarkable to work with you. And I'm thrilled that we get to come together and collaborate again this evening. And thank you to everyone watching who took the time out of your busy schedules to be here. We are thrilled to have you here.
Yeah. So you're going to read a little bit for us, right, before we get started?
Yes. And so those who, if you happen to have the book, please feel free to follow along. If you don't have the book, I certainly hope that you will consider getting the book. But I'm reading from the second chapter. This is a chapter entitled Tell It Like It Is. I'll just read the opening of this chapter, and then we'll certainly have a dialogue about this chapter and the entire book. On July 10th, 2015, Sandra Bland, a 28-year-old Black woman from Illinois, was driving alone in Prairie View, Texas. She was on her way to Prairie View A&M University, where she had recently secured a new position. According to Brian Encinia, the white Texas state trooper who stopped her that afternoon, Bland failed to signal as she moved from one lane to the next. What began as a routine traffic stop quickly escalated when Encinia asked Bland to extinguish her cigarette and immediately exit her car. In only a matter of minutes, Encinia tried to force Bland from the car as he called for backup. He then drew a taser and pointed it directly at Bland. "I will light you up. Get out now." As Bland exited the car, tensions continued to escalate. Within an hour of driving down a quiet street in Prairie View, Bland was stopped, arrested, and later taken to jail in Waller County, Texas. When she was found hanging in her cell 3 days later, the encounter, which had been recorded on the officer's dash cam, circulated widely across the nation. Thousands decried the circumstances that led to Bland's tragic death, questioning the stop, the detainment, and the officer's repeated threats. Although Bland's death was officially ruled a suicide, many rejected the pronouncement, and rightfully so. In addition to the many questions that still remain unanswered concerning Bland's short time in a Waller County jail cell, there is no denying that Encina played a role in her death. Encina's racial profiling, which motivated his decision to stop Bland in the first place, and his failure to de-escalate what should have been a routine traffic stop, led to an unlawful arrest and created the environment that led to Bland's untimely death. Bland's life and the circumstances of her death cast a spotlight on one of the social issues that has dominated public discourse during the 21st century, state-sanctioned violence. Bland's encounter with Encina was recorded and as a result garnered nationwide attention. Yet thousands of Black people in the United States have had similar experiences, tense exchanges with police officers that often amount to a death sentence. In a 2019 Los Angeles Times article, a group of researchers identified police violence as one of the leading causes of death for Black American men. While their research emphasized the experiences of Black men and boys, it also revealed that state-sanctioned violence imperiled Black women and girls to a greater degree than white women. In the years before Bland's confrontation with law enforcement, countless Black women died in police custody, with many of their stories going unnoticed. For example, in December 2002, Nyzah Morris, a Black transgender woman, sustained a fatal head injury while being transported by three Philadelphia police officers. Although local activists worked to shed light on the tragic events of that evening, Morris's case, like so many cases of police violence against Black transgender people, failed to garner much nationwide attention. In July 2015, the same month of Bland's death, several other Black women died in police custody, including Raynette Turner of Mount Vernon, New York, and 18-year-old Kendra Chapman of Homewood, Alabama. Weeks later, officers killed Maya Hall, a young Black transgender woman in Baltimore, after she made a wrong turn while driving on a parkway in Fort Meade. These are just a few of the recent cases of Black women whose lives were cut short by the police in the United States. The threat of violence Black Americans face each time they encounter a police officer today is no different from the fear of lynching Black people felt during each confrontation with a white officer during the Jim Crow era. And this violence was and is not limited to encounters with the police. Black Americans today also face violence at the hands of other agents of the state, including white medical professionals who continue to treat their Black patients differently from patients of other racial groups. Fannie Lou Hamer lived with this fear of everyday public and private acts of violence while navigating the South. During the early 1960s, she used her growing visibility and national platform to share those experiences and denounce the actions of the police, as well as the white doctors who committed acts of violence against Black women through forced sterilizations. For Hamer, one of the strategies for addressing the persistent problem of state-sanctioned violence was the use of public testimony as a mode of resistance and revelation. In this way, the act was driven by both personal and political motivations. A source of empowerment and healing, public testimony also provided a vehicle for Hamer to make her audience co-owners of trauma. Those who listened to Hamer's testimony bore witness to the pain and violence and were therefore transformed by the experience. If the violence Black women endured from the state at the hands of police officers, white physicians, and others was designated, or rather designed to silence them, Hamer refused to capitulate. As Hamer recognized in her day-to-day organizing in the US South, acts of police violence and white mob violence often occurred in secret, behind closed doors, and far from the gaze of others. For every public and documented act of racist violence, dozens more had taken place in secret, never to be counted or documented. In Hamer's view, those who managed to survive these brazen acts of violence needed to serve as public witnesses, speaking truthfully and openly about their painful experiences in an effort to bear witness to the pain and suffering of racial and sexual violence, bringing greater awareness to others and initiating radical changes. "I'm going to tell it like it is," Hamer often warned before her public speeches, as a way to boldly alert listeners to the eye-opening accounts that would soon follow. The mantra, "tell it like it is a political strategy that Hamer employed in her lifetime, and one that remains a powerful feature of African-American culture today. Thank you.
Oh boy, I got so many questions, in particular about the passage you just read, but I think I should start off with the question that I had in my mind before you read, which is, you are a PhD, and one thing that Hamer was very candid about was her education and her lack of formal education and the, and the things that prevented that. And I wonder, I mean, you write in the opening of this book, when you first became aware of her, that you were in, I think you were in graduate school when you first became
undergrad.
Aware of her. And so I wonder, as a now PhD, how particularly do you see her as an inspiration? And in particular, speaking about her in terms of formal education.
Thank you for that question. And one of the things that I talk about in the introduction is how I came to learn about Hamer. Just to give context, I was taking a class on the civil rights movement. I attended Binghamton University, and I was majoring in history and Africana studies, yet it was not until that last year of my undergraduate studies that I encountered Fannie Lou Hamer. There are a couple of things that really resonated with me. I certainly, as you point out, I have a PhD, and yet, you know, a lot of people may or may not know, you know, I'm a first generation college student, and I remember what it was like to be sitting in that classroom at Binghamton and, you know, feeling so out of place. And granted, you know, Binghamton was a wonderful place to go to school. I mean, I certainly loved my time there, but I do remember the feeling of often just not quite fitting in, and largely because I was in so many ways, I felt unprepared for the experience. You know, there were a few people that I could turn to necessarily ask for advice for how to navigate, you know, college life. Here I was far away from my family, and here I was trying to figure out the next steps in my life. You know, I had declared a major in history and Africana studies. I wanted to pursue graduate study. At that time, I had already decided that I wanted to become a historian of the Black experience. But the truth is, I battled self-doubt constantly because of my background, because, you know, I came from a working poor background. I questioned, you know, whether or not I could truly leave a meaningful mark. You know, how do you effect change when you feel like you don't have, you know, much material resources, when you feel like you're not as well connected, when you feel like you lack experience in a lot of these settings? These were the kinds of things that I was dealing with internally. Didn't necessarily talk about it with others, but just felt out of place in those contexts. And as you can imagine, I struggled with that too, right? In many ways, as I was moving forward in my career, you know, when I arrived at Princeton, I battled those feelings. But what I will say is, that the encounter with Hamer was transformative because here, as you point out, is this courageous Black woman who has a sixth grade education. You know, she grows up in poverty in Mississippi, and she has limited material resources, yet she left such a lasting mark. She utilized her gifts and her gifts, including her voice, her skillful ability as an organizer, you know, as a careful listener, as a strategist, as a theorist. She was able to leave such an important mark, not only on the people of Mississippi, but on the entire nation. And I think, you know, anyone who heard Hamer's testimony in 1964 at the DNC, at the Democratic National Convention, can attest to what I'm saying, of how she had the power to speak and draw you in and really compel you to act. So for me, I think finding Hamer in those early years reassured me that in as much as I appreciated the opportunity to, you know, to obtain, you know, an education, I was thrilled to have an opportunity to pursue a PhD, all of that I'm grateful for. But it was important for me in that moment to know that all of these things are somewhat secondary, that, right, that all of these things are meaningful. But in the end, it doesn't really matter so much if you don't utilize these resources and gifts to effect change and to improve the lives of those around you. And so for me, I started to shift from what I didn't have, what I didn't know, to what do I have to offer? What are my skills and abilities? And how can I lean into those to make a difference? And so back then, I dreamt of writing books on Black people. I dreamt about writing history books that would center Black voices and introduce the world to key figures who look like me. And so it's surreal, I mean, but wonderful to be here in this moment to talk about this. And as you know, this is not my first book on Black history, but it's I think it's just wonderful that I had this transformative experience with Hamer. And then now I had the wonderful opportunity to tell her story.
Yeah. You mentioned being in Binghamton and being far from home. And one of the things that Hamer always kept central in her work was Mississippi. And right. I remember writing an article, not on Mississippi, writing an article on the Juneteenth. And right. and learning at one point that Mississippi had more millionaires, I think it was the year 1860, they had more millionaires than any other state in America. Mm-hmm. And just thinking about the wealth, the immense wealth that was there, and then the immense poverty that Hamer often spoke of. And so I wonder, it seems that it looms larger than itself symbolically. So I wonder if you could talk about what Mississippi meant to Hamer, and then what it might have meant to the kind of larger US perspective.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I reflected on in the process of writing the book was how significant it was that Hamer's family remained in the South, that they chose to remain in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And I say this because, you know, I write about the 20th century, I teach about the 20th century, and I always talk about the Great Migration, as so many people do. We talk about, you know, this collective movement, this mass mobilization of people going from the South to northern cities, also to the West, in pursuit of better educational and job opportunities, but also as a collective response to Jim Crow, as a you know, an act of resistance to white supremacy. Not to suggest that people did not encounter racism in the North or in the West. We understand this was a national problem, but there's something about walking away, this context of Jim Crow, at least institutionalized, and then trying to rebuild one's life in a new space, in another context. And so for my first book, you know, Set the World on Fire, I talk a lot about migration, people leaving places like Louisiana, going to Harlem, going to Chicago. All of that is important. But it is also important for us to reflect on families like the Hamer family, a family that decided And I should, you know, step back to say, just because I'm not sure many people have the context, you know, Hamer was born October 6th. So we celebrated her birthday not too long ago, 1917. So this is the context of World War I, certainly. And that is the context in which I'm talking about the Great Migration. When she was about 2 years old, the family decided to move from one town to the next, but they stayed in the state of Mississippi. And so Hamer grew up in just deeply rooted in Mississippi. That's really all that she knew. Now, she had so many opportunities to leave Mississippi. She could have left Mississippi, certainly, you know, in her early adulthood. You know, she could have left even later once she joined the civil rights movement and encountered all kinds of violence. She could have decided to leave just for her personal protection and for her family. But she decided to stay. And the reason that she decided to stay was she believed that she was called to give back to the community that had given so much to her, right? So even in the context of experiencing, you know, poverty, experiencing hunger, I mean, you know, I talk in the book, Hamer would reflect on nights when she would go to bed without much to eat. And she would talk about the struggles, you know, that her parents went through trying to make ends meet. You know, they were sharecroppers. They were in, you know, they were working from sun up to sundown. You know, they were trapped in the system of exploitation that limited their access to obtaining wealth, certainly limited their access to land ownership, among other things. But it was still in that context that Hamer developed her political ideas, because it's in the community, it's among other Black people that Hamer began to, you know, really, I think, figure out her voice. I mean, she sort of came to a full understanding of who she was in that community, despite the experience of poverty, despite the experience of racial violence that I talk about in that first chapter. Hamer's parents instilled in her the importance of having pride in oneself, pride in one's heritage, never looking down on oneself, and recognizing that the sins that are taken, you know, that the shame rather is not the shame that you take upon yourself as the person being oppressed. It really falls on the oppressor, right? It's about shifting the lens and not walking around feeling defeated, even when society has set it up so that, you know, there are all of these attempts to strip away your dignity, even your personhood. And so Mississippi is so central because it's and particularly Ruleville, Mississippi, it's home for Hamer. It's the place where she gets involved in the civil rights act, civil rights movement, and is the place where she decides to stay and to give back of her time, her talents, her abilities to really connect with the people that she truly loved, to make things better for them, and by extension, to seek to make things better for all Americans. And so I think it is impossible to talk about Hamer's political ideas and activism without centering them, particularly in Mississippi, in the Mississippi Delta, to be specific.
Actually, I just want to add that it wasn't a small family. They had the family had 20 kids, so yes. I mean, it's a significant decision to stay put or to move. I was thinking when you were talking about the things that she did in her home state about the Freedom Farm, and I hope I'm not like this is in a spoiler or something, but I wondered if you could talk about the Freedom Farm and how progressive it was. And I wondered also if you thought that this was one of, if not her greatest accomplishment as an activist or organizer.
Yeah. The Freedom Farm is really remarkable. You know, I think before I wrote the book, I certainly heard about the Freedom Farm. I'm indebted to the brilliant work of Monica White, who wrote a book, Freedom. I believe it's Freedom Farmers, and I'll quickly, because I want to make sure I give you all the right title here. But Monica White, yes, it is called Freedom Farmers, wrote this really great book in 2018. Reading that book was wonderful, because that book really gets into, you know, essentially agricultural resistance. You know, and, you know, as we're talking, I'm thinking about a quote that Hamer, there was a time when she was talking about freedom farming. So let me take a step back and give a context before I get to the quote. But in the late 1960s, Hamer established Freedom Farm, which was essentially a collective. It was a community. You might think of it as a community garden. And this was but even more so, I mean, it was a space where Hamer grew crops. This was, you know, her really drawing upon her experience. You know, as I mentioned, she grew up in a sharecropping family. So she and her husband, Perry, you know, also known as Pap Hamer, worked together in cultivating crops. Freedom Farm then provided not only food for anyone in need. And to be clear, you know, Hamer did not turn away anyone. If you had a need, you were welcomed into the farm. You were welcome to show up. And she would charge a small fee. And in fact, if you couldn't even afford the small fee, but you had the need, she would still serve you. So it was not, it was simply an open space for anyone who needed food. But in addition to providing food, it also provided housing. So people actually stayed on the farm, you know, with their children and, you know, educational opportunities and job opportunities. So it just became this a brilliant response to the challenges of hunger and poverty. You have to understand too, you know, as I explained in the book, this is within the context, right? I said the late 1960s, we're talking about a period in time where, this is coinciding with the Great Society program, right? This is coinciding with, efforts from the federal government that are supposed to help uplift people, help lift people out of poverty, essentially, help provide, you know, all the resources they might need. Yet, as Hamer pointed out, the people in Mississippi who were most in need did not have access to those funds. You know, white supremacists, you know, white politicians and others went out of their way to block access to the funds. And so Hamer's Freedom Farm became a practical response. It became a strategy, that she utilized to meet the need. I'll see if I can find the quote, because there's a wonderful quote where she talks about how she conceptualizes the farm and the power of it in the context of living in Mississippi. And I'll see if I could find it quickly as we're talking. If not, then if I find it later, I'll come back to it. But I just, there's such a great line of something that she tells Dorothy Height. So I'll try to find it quickly. Oh, of course, I'm not finding it now. Whenever you need something, you can never find it. But she essentially spoke about how food in the context of Mississippi was used. The phrase was that food was used as a political weapon. Mm-hmm. And so she wanted to underscore the fact that if you could grow your own crops, and then ultimately you didn't have to rely on anyone, and you didn't have to worry about really subjecting yourself to the white power structure, because she understood that at the basic level, people needed sustenance. People needed to be able to care for themselves and their family. And just to have access to crops, to have access, she had a pig farm. She had it was called a pig bank on the farm. I mean, just practical solutions. So I think that is one example of how Hamer tries to come up with concrete ways to address the social issues that she was certainly dealing with in her own life, but also that was shaping the experiences of Black people in Mississippi.
One of the things that I really appreciated about this book was you at points offered criticism or another perspective other than Hamer's. One of the things moments that I'm thinking about in particular was the 1964 convention when she went there determined to obtain seats,
right?
Delegates, and they offer her a symbolic 2 seats, and she is vehement against accepting those seats, even against some of the other Black leaders are saying, yeah, we should accept this. And then I think the argument you mentioned is like, some of them are saying you should accept this because LBJ is going to advance civil rights legislation. And she ultimately mm-hmm. doesn't accept it, which I wrote in the notes when I was reading, oh, she was wrong about that one. Like, he actually did advance civil rights legislation. But I wonder, was it important to you to have that critique of her? Because you could have just presented her as a person who was less fallible or, you know, like didn't make those kind of decisions and ultimately maybe not worked out the right way. So was that important? And to connect that to, you quote journalist John H. Britton, who says that people shouldn't romanticize the qualifications necessary for a Black woman to mm-hmm. win public office. And so I wonder, what aspects of her life do you think are most romanticized? And then was it important to you to show this other side?
Yeah. And it's so difficult, I think. And I encountered some of the same challenges in the first book that I was writing. I often write about individuals with whom I have some sort of connection, meaning that and some people could critique that. I don't know. I part of the reason why I love what I do is because I get to center the voices and experiences. I said earlier about people who look like me, but not surprisingly, I'm sort of, you know, I tend to gravitate to individuals, quite frankly, who remind me of my mom, for example. And I just think that's a beautiful kind of thing. When it comes to writing about historical figures, what I tried to do in this book, what I've tried to do previously, is to avoid... I certainly offer to the best of my ability, I think, a nuanced portrayal whereby I do point out inconsistencies as I see them, contradictions and so on, and allow the readers to get a full sense of the person. At the same time, for me, the goal is to explain as much as possible what compels an individual to either say something or do something or not do something? Like, what's the driving force? You know, what are the ideological underpinnings, for example? You know, what are the ideas going through a person's mind when they decide to resist, when they decide to take a stand in a particular moment? And so that's how I try to approach Hamer in the 1964 convention. And so just to provide some brief context for those who are listening, several months before Hamer gives this powerful speech at the Democratic National Convention, she helps establish the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And this is such an important group that poses a challenge to the state Democratic Party, which had excluded Black participation. And this is not unique to Mississippi. This is true of Southern Democrats in this period. Very resistant to Black involvement. And so this party that Hamer helped establish was a way to point out the inconsistencies, to show not only the state, but really to show the nation and to an extent to show the world the kinds of roadblocks that Black people were facing when they were simply trying to exercise their constitutional right to vote as citizens of the United States. And I'm talking about the Reconstruction Amendments, right? I mean, we're talking about the 19th century rights that should have already been granted, which they were on paper, but in practice, Black people were encountering a number of roadblocks, and the state party was certainly part of the problem. And so when Hamer gets to the DNC, you know, she's making the demand that ultimately that the all-white party that represented the state that was already excluding Black folks, that they not be seated. And ultimately she wanted the delegates of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party to be seated. to send a message that, in fact, this is, you know, a democracy, and we're not going to stand for a party that is excluding the voices of something, you know, an estimated 450,000 people in the state, Black people in the state of Mississippi. So that leads to a number of interesting maneuvers, because in a nutshell, Hamer is just thinking about getting seated. She's just thinking about getting seated. And when she's offered the compromise, two symbolic seats, for her, it's a slap in the face. She did not leave Mississippi and travel all the way to Atlantic City for that. And she was determined to get what she wanted. Now, established leaders, including Martin Luther King Jr., including Roy Wilkins, including Bayard Rustin, all of these folks are saying, listen, just take the two seats. Yes, it's symbolic, but think about, quote unquote, the long game, right? Think about what's coming down the road. And as you point out, we know a year later, you know, the passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, but I would argue that would not have even happened were it not for Hamer's insistence at the 1964 convention, were it not for her powerful voice. But this was a moment where she butted heads with other leaders in the movement because they didn't see her as being strategic enough. But, you know, there's an exchange that I'll read here that I talk about in the book, which I think encapsulates the driving force, right? The sort of, again, the ideological underpinnings, why Hamer is so firm. This is an exchange that she has with Adam Clayton Powell. And this is, you know, a Black politician, right? House of Representatives member. And so he's going to her and he's saying, listen, you need to just accept the compromise. He's trying to get her to acquiesce. And then of course, he tries to pull rank essentially. And he says to her, you know, do you know who I am? Because he's talking to her and she's not giving him the response that he's imagining. And she says, yeah, I know exactly who you are, but I have two questions for you. How many bales of cotton have you picked? Mm-hmm. How many beatings have you taken? That was classic Hamer. It was saying, listen, you know, no disrespect, but let's be clear here. You cannot tell me, right, the Black woman from Mississippi who has endured all that I have endured, who showed up here to speak not just for myself, but for the people of Mississippi, the Black people of Mississippi, and then tell me what I need to do because you have all the right answers, not happening. And that, I think, what was the point of Hamer's resistance was she saw herself as a representative. She saw herself as speaking in the interests of those who are marginalized, you know, those who are in poverty, those who are experiencing hunger and violence in Mississippi. And they wanted full representation and she was not going to go back home without it. So, you know, I think it was important to tell that story and to not demean Hamer for it, you know, really to show why she held her conviction, even when so many people challenged her. And even when, as you point out, things did move in a direction that I think she could not have foreseen. But as I said, I simply don't think Lyndon B. Johnson would have even had the will were it not for someone. I mean, so many different people contributed, you know, to his shift. But I would say Fannie Lou Hamer's powerful testimony, which terrified him so much so he tried to block it, right, that I think it made a difference in the struggle for civil rights broadly.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important also that Carter sends delegates to her funeral, right? So not just one administration. She was a person, a formidable person, even in the next administration. I wanted to say, I see Michelle Fisher. I want to get to your question, Michelle. I see you got a couple of questions. I just got one more question. You mentioned Adam Clayton Powell, and he strikes me as like an erudite, you know, educated, pretty guy. And I was also thinking about like Martin Luther King. And even though she was friends with Malcolm X, like he was still erudite, right? So like, I wondered if you could talk about the intersectional struggles that Hamer recognized and faced, you know, with class, and you don't really talk a lot about it, but I think colorism was also mixed in there. So if you could talk a little bit about that, and then Michelle, I'm getting to your question. Don't worry, I got you.
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, as we're talking about the 1964 convention, there's so many stories that I think capture the tensions within the movement that shed light on, you know, you use the word intersections, which is perfect, because in fact, part of what I argue, you know, in the book, I have this whole chapter on Hamer's ideas about women's empowerment. And I talk about her as a foremother of sorts, you know, of this notion of intersectionality, which we now understand through the writings of legal scholar Kimberly Crenshaw. But at the 64 convention, Hamer, one of the other difficult encounters she has, which, you know, every time I think about it, I remember writing about it and just, I would always pause because I couldn't just imagine what it must have felt like for Hamer, you know, in that context, where Roy Wilkins, you know, a leader of the NAACP, describes her as an ignorant woman. And, you know, it was really, I think, a glimpse of, you know, as you talk about the class divides, the class divisions in the movement. You know, I think the statement revealed multiple things. I certainly do think the statement revealed patriarchy and sexism in the movement. And that is not unique to the moment of 64. You know, I think, you know, even I was reflecting on the March on Washington, right? I mean, as another moment where Black men take center stage, even as, you know, I mean, women are literally, you know, fighting to be given a voice. I mean, they're fighting, they're making demands behind the scenes saying, you know, give us a chance to speak. Yes, it's nice to have a lovely song, you know, someone, you know, sing a solo, but no, give us a chance to speak. And it's clear that even as these activists are so fundamental to the movement, you know, they're key, as I mentioned, as organizers and strategists and so on, they are often pushed to the sidelines and through, you know, these charismatic, you know, Black men as leaders, they are presented to the world as the faces of the movement. And so Hamer, in the statement about Hamer being an ignorant woman, I think it alluded to the patriarchal nature of this, you know, of the civil rights movement. And I should say broadly, I mean, I write about social movements, you know, broadly, and this is, we see these patterns time and time again. Also reflective of the classism, you know, we're certainly talking about, you know, the class divides. I mean, when you say that someone's ignorant, we understand the implications there. They are alluding to, at the same moment, you know, the limited formal education that Hamer has, and the assumption, right, that because, you know, they have more formal education, it means that they are anointed to be the speakers and the representatives of the race and them alone. I mean, it's the politics of respectability kind of, you know, rising to the surface yet again, and I think you just see all of these tensions come to the surface in that particular moment. So Hamer dealt with, I think, a lot of resentment and you know, within the movement because of her socioeconomic background, you know, because of her limited formal education, because, right, you know, of, you know, the fact that she was a woman asserting her voice in a male-dominated space, and here I'm talking about leadership space, or rather visible leadership space. So I think those are moments where I suspect, you know, readers might be a bit surprised, but I think it really reinforces how courageous Hamer was, because it's, you know, it's one thing to deal with white supremacists, it's one thing to deal with, you know, folks attacking you because you are trying to expand Black political rights. Is another thing to have to be fighting internally too, you know, among the people who, you know, are deeply invested, right? They're deeply invested too, you know, they're part of the, I mean, I'm not suggesting that any of these folks were somehow disconnected to the greater cause for liberation. They were committed, but that's the point. They were so committed that they wanted to handpick who they saw as the perfect leaders to present to the world. And Hamer didn't fit the mold for them. But as it turns out, she was exactly the leader that I think we all needed, right, in that particular moment. And I think part of what the book does, I hope it certainly, is that it gets us to see how the civil rights movement was made possible through an array, right? Through a diverse group of activists, people from all backgrounds. And in this context, you know, a Black, you know, impoverished, disabled Black woman from Mississippi with a sixth grade education ended up speaking so powerfully in 64 that it caught everyone's attention and it made a difference. We're still talking about it today.
Yeah. Michelle, I told you I was going to get to you and I am going to get to you right now. As a reminder that there's a link to buy the book in the chat. So you all should go there, click on the link, buy one for now, buy one for Christmas, get you one for Thanksgiving too. So one of the things, I think the thing that shocked me the most that I did not know about Hamer was about the forced sterilization. And that to me was probably the most egregious thing that happened to her personally. And so Michelle Fisher's question is to me connected to that. She says, Ms. Hamer endured so many acts of traumatic events by those in power in her era. How did you protect yourself from the impact of vicarious trauma as you did your research? And what are your suggestions for researchers to protect their mental health?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I have to say that it was so difficult. And I think one of the reasons, there are many reasons why it was difficult to write about even, you know, the forced sterilization as an example, even to write about the brutal beating in Winona. But one of the reasons why I struggled with it too was, you know, I wrote this book with two different perspectives, you know, as you've already gleaned from the way that I read the excerpt earlier. I'm both telling Hamer's story grounded in the 60s and the 70s, you know, contextualized through the frame of the civil rights movement, but also connecting that story to the present day. And forcing, I think, you know, everyone as readers, forcing you to draw those connections, to see those connections, to understand that this isn't solely, oh, this is a story of the past. Okay, you know, interesting read. No, it's a story of the past. And it's also a story of the present. And so acknowledging that, I think, meant that as I'm writing about these painful experiences that Hamer is enduring, I'm also grappling with the fact that so many of these things are happening today. I mean, I remember, and I suspect many people do too. I remember when the story broke about, you know, practices of forced sterilization, you know, at I believe it was a sort of an immigrant immigration center, and I'm completely blanking on the specifics, but this was probably, I want to say last year, you know, we were all just shocked by the stories of the violence that immigrant women were enduring. And I thought immediately of Hamer, right? I mean, in today's context, when you talk about forced sterilizations, I think the general understanding is that, okay, you know, perhaps it's not as common as it was in the 1960s. But even if it's not as common, you know, even if you try to make that case, does it make you feel any better to know that it's happening at all, right? But the fact that it is happening is a reminder of how much we have to be part of the struggle to, how much we have to be part of Hamer's struggle, how much we have to continue the work that she started, right? And so it became really a living history. And so in writing about the traumatic experiences, I felt like I was reliving it too. And I don't necessarily have all the answers. I mean, I will admit, which I have never shared before. I mean, I will admit in this space that perhaps in the process of writing the book, it was the very first time in my life, you know, that I, you know, decided to see a therapist, right? I mean, and I say that because I think oftentimes as writers and thinkers, we don't often talk about how the work affects us emotionally, We don't talk about mental health nearly as much as we should. But I think this was a pivotal moment for me because it brought everything to the surface. Not only in thinking through some of my own painful experiences, that I haven't, necessarily spoken about publicly. So it was triggering in that sense, but it was also recognizing that so little had changed. And so it was connecting Hamer's experience, to Breonna Taylor, for example, connecting, to Sandra Bland, as I mentioned, connecting to all of these developments, right? And even to, thinking about your own work, Mitchell, to Ahmaud Arbery. I mean, it just, there were all of these moments where I could see the connections to Hamer, and it weighed heavily on me as a writer, and I needed to make sure that I had someone to talk through all of this. So that's, I don't have a full, I don't have full advice, but maybe in giving the example of kind of the steps I took, maybe that'll be meaningful for someone else.
Yeah. One of the things that was really special about her was actually her poetry. Like you quote several of her quotes, but the ones about which she's most famous are like lines of poetry. One of them being, "I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired." Mm-hmm. And you mentioned how little things had changed. And it made me think about two things. One, about the idea of Afro-pessimism. And the other about, and I know maybe we're going too philosophical here in the last 8 minutes, but I was also thinking about Derek Bell's interest convergence theory, where it's like, white people will really only do things for people they consider a minority if it'll help them. And I wondered if you could see her ideology in relationship to either of those ideas. She seems very hopeful, but is also like a realist to me, which is maybe not pessimism. And then also this idea that, like it seems like her decision in 1964 was like kind of like in line with the convergence theory.
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting because what I think Hamer, what I really appreciate about Hamer is she often tried to balance both optimism and skepticism. So I'll put it that way. I'm struck by the way that she would constantly refer to the Constitution, right? I mean, it's an interesting sort of process where you're pointing to a document and you're saying, listen, look, here are the rights granted to us by the Constitution. Now, you are very much aware of the limitations of the law, right? You understand, she was not oblivious. So I sometimes would chuckle because I would say, well, here she is. On the one hand, she's pointing out the limitations. She's saying, listen, folks are getting away with all kinds of things, even when it comes to lynching, she talks about the complicity of law enforcement. And like, it's clear to her that regardless of what's written on paper, people will continually find ways to restrict, Black people from the vote, for example, but from all kinds of privileges and opportunities. So she's aware of that, yet she keeps saying, yeah, but look what you have written on paper. And I see this as some might see it as contradictory, but no, I see it as this balanced approach to having hope, going back to the core ideals, going back to the core values and saying, listen, we can in fact live up to this, right? We can in fact build this inclusive democracy. We can do that work. And then saying, but look at all the roadblocks before us, right? But look at the way that people have circumvented the law. So I think it was, what I can best describe as a healthy dose of optimism, right? I mean, and I would argue, and this is not, a slight to Afro-pessimist or anything, but I would argue that it is very difficult to engage in political struggle without a sense of optimism, right? You have to believe that change is possible. You have to believe that the steps you take today could make things better, if not in your lifetime, right? For someone else who, and you may never ever witness it, but you hope that you are breaking things apart, that you are cracking, right, the system, so to speak, and that perhaps 30 years, 40, maybe 100 years, someone will feel and experience, you know, the full effect of all the work that you might have done, and that you never, even if you never enjoyed, right, to even if you never experienced the fruit of your labor. And so I think there has to be optimism, because I think without it, I'm not quite sure where the impulse comes from to keep pushing, to keep demanding change, to keep coming up with solutions, to keep strategizing. Like, I don't see where the impulse comes from, if not hope that things could change. At the same time, you have to have skepticism and recognizing that A, it's not going to happen easily. B, every time you make a step forward, there will be a whole lot of backlash. History has already revealed that to us. And you have to be willing to adapt, right? So you have to be willing to come up with strategies in one moment and perhaps shift to another, because what might have worked 2 years ago might not work today. So I just think that's how Hamer fits in ideologically, is recognizing the importance of both impulses.
Yeah. Okay, so we have 3 minutes. I'm going to give you an impossible question. It's really Michelle's question, but I also wanted to preface it by saying, and I can't remember the person's name, but there's a moment you write about where a young man, I think it was a man who was integrating Mississippi, University of Mississippi, maybe, is shot and killed. I think.
Oh, yes. James Meredith. He wasn't killed, but he was injured. Yes. Okay. James Meredith. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Maybe. Is it Meredith? Okay. Well, she takes up she starts like advocating for him, takes up starts a fund to fund. And it really felt like a precursor, yes, for the way that Black Lives Matter operated. And so Michelle's question is, you studied Ms. Hamer as a key political thinker along with MLK, Malcolm X, Rosa Parks. What recommendations would you offer Ms. Hamer's incomparable activism and contribution to civil rights to younger generations? So what can we take from Hamer and offer to younger generations in the span of just 2 minutes?
Wow, there's so many things. I mean, you know, in essence, I feel like the book answers that question and tries to provide an array of examples. With a short time, you know, and so just to provide context, so I think you were thinking of Joefa Collier, you know, yes. I talk about this is a yes. So this is a young Black woman who was shot and killed by white supremacists, and just 18 years old. I mean, it was just terrible right after her graduation. Just,
yes, that's right.
1971. And so Hamer, it's just remarkable. Hamer just physically, literally, but even just figuratively, puts her arms around this family and decides that she's going to help them, and she's going to stand with them, and she's going to, you know, provide. I mean, she starts a fund to, you know, to ultimately raise, you know, money for them so that they could make sure, you know, to have a good place to live. I mean, she was so moved by this tragic killing. And I think there's so many aspects of Hamer's story that I think we can carry into this particular moment. You know, one thing that I would emphasize is the power of grassroots leadership. And what I mean by that is we are at a moment, and this is not unique to this moment. I think this is true historically. There's often an impulse to sort of anoint one or two individuals as leaders of movements. We see this with Black Lives Matter, right? And this is absolutely not meant to overlook the crucial work of the founders of the movement. I certainly want to recognize these three, you know, remarkable Black women who I think has truly, I mean, forced all of us, not just nationally, but globally, to grapple with state-sanctioned violence, anti-Black racism, right? This is all important. But my point is not even to talk about them in particular, but to say that oftentimes when it comes to media portrayals, the focus tends to be on one or two individuals. What that does is that it sort of obscures the critical work of grassroots organizers who are often not covered, you know, on nightly news. And, you know, the folks who are working within their communities on a day-to-day basis often do not have much resources and support. You know, people aren't sending money to help necessarily. And yet they are pushing and pushing and pushing. And, you know, there's so many people, I think, on the grassroots level who, you know, just like Hamer, I think if we tap into their leadership potential, if we provide support and resources, the sky's the limit when we think about, you know, what they could do. And so I hope that if nothing else, in reading the book, it would send this message that all of us have the potential to make a difference, you know, regardless of what our educational background might be, regardless of our socioeconomic status, regardless of, you know, our ability, you know, our race, you know, our gender, ethnicity, like all of these factors, I think should certainly not be roadblocks to our ability to figure out what it is we can contribute to make our communities better, certainly, but on a national level to make the nation better. I hope that Hamer's story gets people to start thinking about their own potential influence in shaping American history. So that's what I will end with. And I just want to, you know, reinforce my thanks to all of you for being here, for listening to me. And I hope that you find the book useful.
What a way to end. Thank you for asking me to join you. It's an education, wonderful book to read. And I wish you all the best on the rest of your tour.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.